as the alternative information development center. Mark Weinberg. Okay. You know, today, at least the only name that I managed to master was Master Sick. Further the rest, I had to use my friend's understanding of the spelling. Mr. Mark, we are all yours, my sir, because we have already lost about 10 minutes. You have been with us. You know the procedures and the process. Yeah. So, you are welcome.
Thank you very much, Chairperson and honorable members, for the opportunity to present here on behalf of the Alternative Information Development Center. I'm going to be assisted in my presentation by Alison Tilley from ODAC, who's given the AIDC legal support on this submission, as well as I've invited Murray Hunter from the Right to Know campaign to join me, because in our written submission, we say that the AIDC is an active member of the campaign and supports the Right to Know submission. So there may be questions related to that that Murray can deal with. The structure of my presentation is going to come in three parts: an introduction, which will give a background to AIDC and our guiding assumptions.
There's a point as well, Mark.
Just to be clear, sir, does it mean that your submission will be together with the Right to Know campaign? So
not at all. The Right to Know campaign is scheduled, I think, for Friday to present. There may be issues contained in my presentation that the campaign is best positioned to speak to. So he's really just there as part of the AIDC team to support us and to give the best responses we can to the members.
No, Mark, then that is going to give us a problem. I thought you said they are just there. But if you say they are going to assist you or to be part of your presentation, then it will create some problems. Because you see, when we selected, when we shortlisted as an organization,
okay. I think in the interest of progress, we can ask the Right to Know campaign not to participate in this session and keep their contribution for Friday.
Yes.
Okay.
All right. Let's separate the two.
Clear. Okay. Okay. So the structure of the presentation looks at an introduction, that's background to AIDC, and our guiding assumptions, the context of the bill. And I think compared to a lot of the inputs we heard this morning, AIDC submission takes a much bigger frame on the issue. We look at the multiple, what AIDC terms the multiple crises of civilization, populist authoritarianism, and the rise of the securocrats. And then the AIDC submission focuses in on access to information, looking at a hard-won right, the relationship between PIA and the POSIP, and protection of whistleblowers, before we conclude. The background on AIDC, Alternative Information Development Center is a non-profit trust formed in 1996 in response to the democratic transition in South Africa and new opportunities and challenges that the transition brought to those seeking greater social justice within the democracy. We work to strengthen the movement for social justice by giving voice to the poor and marginalized locally and internationally. Our guiding principles. We recognize that the right to access and share information is fundamental to the pursuit of social justice. These rights underpin our democracy and are a precondition to the realization of further socioeconomic rights enshrined in our Constitution. As a matter of principle, we maintain that a responsive and accountable democracy can only exist if it creates as few secrets as possible. We therefore recognize the need to repeal apartheid-era security laws that are still on the statute books, as well as the minimum information security standards in place today. Turning to the context, in our oral submission, we talk about the multiple crises of civilization. which suggests that there are three converging global crises taking place at the moment: an economic crisis, a social crisis, and an ecological crisis. The economic crisis is characterized, and here I'm just going to sketch these very, very briefly. The economic crisis is characterized by overaccumulation and overproduction, jobless growth at best, and mass structural unemployment, failed agrarian reform, and the state being a key tool to accumulate capital for a comparable class, which is often identified as corruption. The social crisis is characterized by hunger and food insecurity, the massive burden of disease and health system failure, failed rural development, mass urbanization, a housing crisis, and then violence, widespread, gendered, xenophobic, homophobic, etc. The ecological crisis, characterized by our economic dependence on fossil fuels, that's particularly acute in South Africa with our dependence on the energy mineral complex, significant climate change, which is inevitable, which will result in large-scale migration, water wars, and food fights. Within this context, a state needs to govern. And the question or the tension is always between governing by consent, which is implied by a democracy, or governing by cohesion, force, etc. So as social cohesion falters, we have witnessed
I'll keep on disturbing you. I really want to know, and please clarify to me, so that I have a better understanding. Ready to govern. Do you take what is one political party or organization's program or whatever and put it here as well? I'm not sure what are we doing.
In our concept, our goal is to suggest, you know, looking at the presentation, it has got, firstly, we don't have hardcore copies that you are presenting here, because it's quite different from your submission. And secondly, it raises serious, you are raising serious political statements in the presentation so far. I don't know what is there now, further down. Without really limiting you or denying you, I would suggest that if it is possible, that let's get to the bill, and speak to it. Yes, of course, you do have the right to make reference to other issues and so on. Because my biggest fear is by the time we engage, we might be trapped in certain political connotation that comes out of your presentation and really lose the gist of your input in relation to the bill. And that might deny us as a committee an opportunity to really reflect on the key issues that you are raising to empower the committee to really consider those matters. I don't know if you are comfortable with that. If you are not, we are not going to stop you with your presentation, but I'm just cautioning that if we approach it in this way, it may raise a lot of things. Because now already, if you talk about South Africa's growing protest, one political party may question, what are the reasons for that? Then we get trapped in the reasons for protests and so forth, whether it be them escalating or going down or stabilizing or whatever and so forth. I don't know if you are comfortable with that.
Our written submission, which we were invited to present on, if you remove the introduction and conclusion, is 2 pages long. And one of those pages does look at the context, because we submit in our written submission that it's important when considering the bill to understand it in its socio-economic context. And the slide that we're coming to, I think, next, locates the rise of the securocrat, within the context of the social and economic instability engulfing the globe and impacting South Africa. So the purpose of the last few slides is not to suggest that this committee needs to debate the validity of this assessment. My understanding was that AIDC is invited to present.
Are you speaking of this one? This submission.
My version looks like that.
Let us first proceed, Mr. Chief, but I just thought that I must caution you that we don't get trapped in a political debate instead of really looking at the big.
Yeah, I'll count on you as the chair to help guide us in that direction.
Chair? Can I make a motion? No, Chair. Perhaps here you need to say and the presenters. I'm trying now, like you say, I'm having difficulties to understand, because what he's saying, whatever that is presented now informs whatever conclusion we have on the bill itself. And correctly so, some of the statements and analysis that is being presented here cannot, we can't just keep quiet and say, well, whether they are right or wrong. It will require us now to get into that, and that is the deviation from our work. Now, the other point I have as a problem is that at the beginning of this particular presentation, Mr. Weinberg indicated that he might have difficulty in terms of giving clarity to some of the questions that might arise out of this document. Hence, he requires the assistance of Right to Know campaign. So we don't want a situation, and as he changed when he indicated the problem, he never given you or us the comfort of saying, despite this change in the approach, I will be in the position to answer all the questions. You see, we would not want a situation where he's unable to give us clarity on questions. But it is to introduce his submission by venturing into socio-economic politics, then it's going to create problems for us. And I would suggest, humbly so, Chair, that perhaps in light of the fact that one of their allies in the form of Right to Know will be seeing us on Friday, they should go back and find a way of capturing their things within that one of Right to Know, but really staying away from bringing the socio-economic politics into the whole picture of this lawmaking process, because it's going to now push us to a level where we will be unrestrained in terms of having to venture into such politics.
Honourable Bloom.
Gentlemen, thank you very much. I will agree with my learned friend here next to me. Let me tell you.
Are you learned, Lord?
Yeah, no,
he's second day.
He's an advocate, this man. So I will ask. Let's ask them to go back and prepare and come back on Friday. Yeah, with a Right to Know, because you see, it's now a complicated a submission that they are presenting to us. Now, in all fairness, we are asking them to go back and go and prepare properly and come back on Friday. Thank you.
Honorable Donald, is out of order. Honorable Mufokin.
Chairperson, I think it is not fair. We have called them to present. Let them present. Let us hear that presentation.
Honorable Louis?
No, Chair, I was going to raise the same point as the Honorable King is saying, because, Chair, you've now cautioned them, you've explained the implications of their presentation, and they are okay with it, so I'm not sure what we're trying to fix now. So I'm seconding for King that let's give them the chance, we've allocated time. And that's it, Chair. And they've also said that Right to Know will not respond. If they can't respond to questions, it's fine, Chair. They know the implications of what, according to your caution. Thanks.
No, that's fine. If we resolve to Honorable Matilda and Honorable Gunda,
I don't have a problem with the last proposal, but the issue that I think is important here is that we want to deal with the bill. We don't want political statements. If they can clarify us as to whether they're going to deal with the bill rather than deal with the issues they are raising now here, because we don't want to deal with those particular issues. We've asked them to come and deal with the bill. You know, they know what is in front of us. And that is the situation. If they can't clarify us on that, then I'll agree with Chani that no, let them go and prepare.
Sir, I would like to support what Honorable Matilda is just saying. I just want to go a step further. Whenever people, we invited people here with the main purpose to come and speak to the concerns that they have on the bill. Nothing else. So, Chair, it's not going to be fair here today. You have also bear in mind we're going to have COSATU. What if COSATU is coming and also raise the very same social issues? How long are we going to sit here? So, Chair, all I'm asking, we must speak to the bill. When you read through their documents, let them speak to their concerns to us. We are here to listen to them. Let them speak to them. Thank you, Chair.
Okay, I think the Honorable Lee, what's your take?
Mr. Chairman, I've kind of held back on this one, but there's a lot of merit in what's being said. However, the written submission was received, and we read it, and we then invited them to come and do a presentation. The written submission follows the same theme as the oral submission is now being made. So I'm a bit hesitant about making comments on, you know, if we wanted it to be restricted to the bill, then perhaps we should have said so when we invited and said, look, your written submission doesn't really deal specifically with nuts and bolts of the bill. We want you to come and do that. But we didn't. So I'm in a little bit of a difficult position, Mr. Chairman. I understand the concern. I do understand it. But we didn't make this clear.
You see, maybe that's one thing that we also need to clarify. That issue has been communicated. That is why if you look at all the people who have been presenting, if you look at their original submission, they have really extrapolated issues that speak to the bill in relation to their presentations here. The submission is voluminous, but when you look at the presentation that they come with here in this chamber, it speaks to those strategic issues. I mean, I just wanted to raise an issue that can create serious deviation, if not problems for us in engaging with the presentation. Already, that is why I started getting worried to say, reading as social coercion falters have witnessed the emergence of greater authoritarianism, militarization, and the rolling back of human rights in the democracies across the world. In South Africa, we have seen the growing influence of conservative authoritarianism in our growing politics as popular discontent grows. There are serious ideological and theoretical statements that have been made there that can be extremely contested. And it would be unfair, even as the chair, sitting here and allowing these statements to be made to the committee and leave them unchallenged. Because if they leave them unchallenged, it would mean that as a committee we agree with that. It would mean, therefore, that we agree with that. And I, for one, I don't agree with it. From the beginning, I don't agree with that. So it will pepper. That is my problem. It will happen in a political discussion or debate instead of really looking at the core issue. Let me find out from Mr. Weinberg whether if it will be difficult, just as he proposed earlier when we started, to say that this approach was going to be an approach that then seeks to bring together his input and that of the right to know as a presentation in terms of support, because the issues speak to the to the same area, and also as an affiliate of the Right to Know, would he find it difficult for him to make a presentation under the umbrella of the Right to Know on Friday?
Well, the Right to Know has already identified their spokespeople, so I wouldn't see much value in that. The AIDC was invited to make a written submission along with everyone else in South Africa. We did so. What's been presented so far is in the written position. We've been invited to present it orally, and I don't think the Right to Know campaign is going to, in fact, I know their written submission, so I doubt their oral submission is going to capture these concerns. The AIDC's view is that when considering a piece of legislation, it's important to consider it within its broader context. The Right to Know, their written submission takes an approach very similar to submissions we heard this morning, looking at the legislation clause by clause, whereas AIDC's submission makes very general comments on the bill itself, and the bulk of our submission, because we are aware that that's where we believe we can add value. Not that we would for a second expect members of the committee to agree with our perspective, and I don't think by failing to engage it line by line is an indication of your consent or agreement. We felt it was an important perspective for you to consider, and we were very happy to be invited to present it orally, and we'll respect your ruling on that.
Mr. Weinberg, present.
Okay. So, within this broader global crisis,
he says that this presentation is of a general comment, in a nature of general comment. The reason why, I didn't want to explain myself, the reason why, but let me do it for the benefit of everybody present. The reason why I'm saying that it must continue is because of we allowed the thing, Draconian, or not Draconian, what is it? Diaconian church council, who were also very general this morning. So let's allow him, and then at the end of his presentation, we will either note the presentation or disassociate ourselves from the presentation. But let's allow him. It was just taking much of our time. I don't want for us to go over a vote on a simple matter. Please. Honorable President.
Chair, my worry is I'm being invited to debate socio-economic political issues. By the mere fact that there are those words that are there in public, South Africa, we have seen a growing influence of conservative authoritarian. Whatever that says, wants me to come in and, you know, because it's not about the bill, it's about the country that I come from. And it has an influence on my how I view my own country in their eye as they speak. So I'm not, let's just understand that we are not here to waste time on their platform where we can talk about such issues. Not here. Please, Chairperson. And if we are going to allow him to present, unless he says, no, let me go to the bill, but if we are going to allow him to present and continue presenting in this line, and he says to us, he doesn't have to go line by line to make sure that we consent or not consent with what he is saying, he's totally out. I'm not prepared to listen any further to what he has to say if this is his line. Thank you.
Chair President, you know if we haven't intercepted the gentleman with that document, I think he should have finished by now. And whether the contents of the document are relevant to the bill or not. For now, it's not an issue. Yesterday, the last presentation, in my opinion, was also totally irrelevant to the bill we're discussing it, and we allowed the gentleman to present. Let us allow the gentleman to present.
Ahmad, can I make a ruling with this? Can you all respect that ruling? Can you all respect that ruling? She continue.
Thank you. So in the previous slide, we're suggesting that there are three major systemic crises engulfing the planet, impacting on South Africa. This graph demonstrates the rising recorded by police protests in the country since 2004, and then members of the committee have raised concern about this suggestion that there's growing conservative authoritarianism in the country. The next slide presents examples of the trend to conservative authoritarianism presented through the frame of the right to organize, which is a right based on three constitutional rights, the freedom of expression, access to information, and freedom of assembly. And to very quickly run through some of the trends and developments that we identify. In terms of the freedom of expression, we see the ICASA Amendment Bill, intimidation of journalists, harassment of activists, the proposed Media Appeals Tribunal, proposed internet pornography legislation, and the General Intelligence Amendment Bill. In terms of access to information, we've seen large failures to implement the Promotion of Access Information Act, intimidation, harassment, and even murder of whistleblowers, and the Protection of State Information Bill in its current form. In terms of the freedom of association and assembly, we've seen increased police violence and intimidation, the denial of permission to gather as a growing trend, the introduction of Vicar and Ficar databases, the traditional court bill currently before Parliament, and proposals to regulate the funding of NGOs. It's in this context that we also see the rise of securocrats. The tendency towards greater conservative authoritarianism must also be understood in the context of the battle between various factions and groups fighting for influence in the ruling party and the state. The so-called Alliance of the Wounded, cobbled together people of Fani, is weakening and its fissures rupturing.
Now you are giving me problems. What am I doing? No, now you are giving me problems. No. Honorable members, can you give me... I'm still sharing. No, now you are giving me problems, and I know that I'm going to be accused of having denied you an opportunity to speak. We cannot continue with this. We can't continue. No, we can't. We can't. There are serious political statements now that we are further making. We are making reference to the Polokwane conference and all those sorts of things. Now this is political. Can we stop this presentation? Can you stop this presentation? We are not going to allow you to continue with the presentation. Can we have the next presentation? Yeah, no, can't continue that.
Just on the last point of information.
The president, a picture there. I really feel like really laughing like that.
No. That is very offensive. It's very offensive. Very, very offensive. It would have been good if we were a lobby group somewhere there, if someone was seeking for funding for a protest. We are not lobbying for a protest here. Can we have a second presentation? Are they ready? Okay, can you come forward, Chief, and make your presentation? But Chair.
some of the issues
that we saw in the bill that we feel will impinge on the enjoyment of academic freedom. But before I go to the main issues that we identified, I wish to make some preliminary observations. The first preliminary observation that we are making is that the right to academic freedom is a recognized right in South African Constitution under Section 16. The second point you are making is that the Constitutional Court has recognized the link between the enjoyment of academic freedom with access to information. In the case of Brahma versus Minister for Social Development and others, the court specifically said that academic freedom would be useless if access to information is not guaranteed. Then the third point I want to make is that we are coming in from the position that academic freedom is not absolute, and that the Constitution actually recognizes that academic freedom can be limited under Section 36, the general limitations in the Constitution. But having recognized that academic freedom is not absolute, it is my fourth preliminary observation that the way the bill has gone about realizing the noble objective of guaranteeing the national security of South Africa in a way impinges on the enjoyment of academic freedom. And basically my presentation will be to look at how it does that, and I will raise some of those issues during my presentation. And so before I go to my presentation, just as Dr. Price informed the honorable members, our presentation is divided into two parts. My part will be to highlight those issues that we feel, if not addressed by this parliament, will lead to academic freedom not being enjoyed in this country. And then the second part will be presented by Professor Duncan. And Professor Duncan will take us through the specific issues, the specific challenges that an academician or an academic researcher would encounter if this bill is passed the way it is. And so to go to my presentation, what I thought of doing is that since we had submitted our written submission. And in our written submission, we have actually gone clause by clause and analyzed some of the shortcomings that we feel are obtaining in those clauses. And because of the limited time that we have for this sort of submission, the way I'll approach my presentation is not to go through clause by clause analysis, but actually to look at some three general issues that we feel are specific to academicians with regard to this right. But just to show that these three issues that I'll be raising are not exclusive, it's just to give out some of the issues that we mentioned in our written submission that I believe honorable members have had time to go through, or if they haven't, they will have time to go through. Of course, you have identified the overproof definition that are provided for under the Act, and we are raising the issue that national security is not specifically defined, and I think other presenters have raised the same issue. We are also raising the issue that the state security matter as defined under the Act is also not exhaustive, and it brings in a number of issues that we will be discussing later on how the discretion of public officers will be applying the Act might actually be overbroad. We have also looked at the issue of bulk classification, where the bill is now saying that if 1% of information in a document raises issues of national security, then the whole document should be classified. And we are saying that that in itself is an overbroad approach in the bill, that definitely does not have any basis in the Constitution. We have also looked at the period of declassification, and it was raised here in the morning, and it's our view that the period of 20 years is too much, and that and we will raise this specifically with respect to academicians. We think that the 20 years period is too much because of comparative statistics that we looked at in the written submission, and we are proposing that instead of the 20-year period, we should have a 10-year period. Of course, then there is also the issue of a prolonged process in accessing information. We are also raising issues on the composition and independence of the panel review, the review panel rather. We are also looking at the issue of lack of public interest and public domain defense. Those are basically the main issues that we have raised in our written submission. The next 10 minutes that I have, I'm not going to use it to look at all these issues. I want to concentrate my submission on three issues that we feel as an academic institution is going to impinge on academicians. The first issue is what we are calling the prolonged process in accessing information. If you look at section 19 of the bill, the bill specifically provides that if a request for information reveals a breach of law or imminent threat to public health and environment, and then the organ of state to which the application has been made is being mandated to consider that application within 15 days. Our issue is not with that. Our issue is with the fact that the bill goes further to say that in instances where a request for information does not reveal those areas that have been identified by the bill, then the organ of state has been given an indeterminate reasonable time within which to consider such a request. It is our view that if that bill goes the way it is, then researchers will actually find it very difficult to access information. And this is because, one, academic researchers are usually constrained by two things. One, time. The second is resources. And so if a researcher wants to use classified information, according to the bill, he'll have to apply to the organ of state to get that information. And because the information cannot be granted within a specified time, an organ of state has the discretion to take more than 30 days. And it can actually argue because that the bill allows him to argue that that was reasonable in their own estimation. And we feel that if let's say, for example, a master's student who has only 1 year to finish his master's, and he wants to use a classified information, and he's being subjected to a fact that he has to apply to the organ of state, the organ of state has to take its time. And if it is refused, he has to again appeal to the minister. And if the minister refuses, he has to go to court. We are saying that the process, with respect to academicians, makes it impossible to enjoy academic freedom. We are proposing that the best way to deal with this issue, especially with regard to academicians, is to look at what the European Court on Human Rights said about the issue of research. In the case that appears in the written submission that we gave you, the European Court was faced with a case where a Turkish national was researching on how an anti-drug bill would affect the lives of the citizens of Turkey. And the information that they required was classified. And so when he made the application for that information to be granted, the government, in its discretion, which it had according to the Act, that was obtaining in that country, refused that application. And they were saying that the only way they could have allowed the person to get the information is if he could identify that research amounts to public interest. And so when the case was brought before the European Court said that the best way to help researchers, given the time constraints and the resource constraints that they usually face, is to include issues of research under the rubric of public interest. It is our submission, Honorable Chair and members of Parliament, that public interest does not only concern itself with negative issues. The way it has been defined under the Act is that it's only those issues that affect negatively the people of South Africa will amount to public interest. If you look at this decision, the decision is also saying that things that are also beneficial to South Africa should also be considered as public interest. And so it's our submission that issues of research, so as to help academicians overcome the constraints that they have, should also be included within the issues of public interest override, so that when they apply for information, then that information should be processed as quickly as other issues that amount within the public interest override. That is our submission. The second point that I want to raise is on the registration of foreign nationals. And this basically goes to section 41 of the bill. If you look at section 41 of the bill, it makes it an offense for a foreigner not to be registered as an intelligence agent. One, if he's an intelligence agent of the country from which he comes. And we don't have a problem with that. We have a problem with the second link of that definition, that he can also be found liable for not registering if he has the potential or expectation of being a foreign intelligence agent. It is our view that if unchecked, this provision can actually be used to frustrate foreign researchers who are critical of the policy of government or who are critical of government generally. And our argument actually is not out of the world. If you look at the history, and we have pointed it out in our recent submission, if you look at the history in America during the Cold War, most academicians were targeted by the government at the time because they had views that were contrary to the government of the day. And we are saying that this ground of potential or expectation of being a foreign intelligence, it is too overbroad, and that it can be misused by security agencies to frustrate and to harass people who are not in line with their policies or their ways of thinking. And so we are submitting that to help, because we are saying that one of the ways of helping academicians in South Africa is to help them also go out there in the world so that they can also experience what is happening there. And that is the whole purpose of academic exchange program. And that to help realize the importance of academic exchange program, that this clause should actually delete the part that provides for criminalization of being a potential or expecting to be a foreign intelligence agent, and should only concentrate on people who are one intelligence agent of their foreign, or people who came here innocently but subsequently became intelligence agents in their country. That is, only if it puts it like that, then there will be definitive in the application of this provision. My last point, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members of Parliament, is to look at a very controversial issue. The whole purpose of academic freedom is to allow academicians to research for information wherever it is found. In the process of researching for information, an academician can come into contact with information that is classified, but that is already in the public domain. Because most of our information, we get them from public sources, we get them from the internet, we get them from the library, and we also get them from archives that are public domain. What the bill is saying is that if you possess a classified information, that you are found out there during research, then it is now an offense. And that if you disclose or you publish that information, there is also a subsequent offense. We are saying that the only way to protect, because it will be putting a lot of burden on academicians to, first of all, when they get an information out there that is written classified, to call the relevant institutions and confirm whether that information is classified. And we are saying that that is undue burden on members of the academy. And so we are saying that the only way to protect members of the academy and to ensure that they enjoy academic freedom in an open society that South Africa is trying to engender is to introduce a public domain defense among the many defenses that have been provided for under the bill. I want to stop there so that I'm not accused of being overbroad, and invite my colleague to just take us through the specific challenges that an academician or a researcher would face if this bill were to come into law. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Ken, and thanks, Honourable Chair, for the opportunity. The purpose of this part of the presentation is to try and reflect on some of the implications of what Ken has spoken about for academic freedom, which, as he's mentioned, is protected under a freedom of expression in the Constitution. Now, just to start out, I'd like to identify some of the potential roles that academic research could play in relation to the security cluster. So the first potential role is that it could help the security cluster to identify strategic priorities and ensure that its policies are kept under constant review. It could ensure that the security cluster is held to account for its actions. It can help to analyze the deeper processes at work in the security cluster, as opposed to journalism, because often what journalism tends to do is it tends to be quite event-focused, whereas academics at least have the space and the resources at their disposal to often drill down deeper into events that are taking place and to analyze some of the conjunction and systemic issues that are impacting on the security cluster. And then also, academic teaching and research can assist the security cluster to draw crucial lessons from problems that may have emerged in the cluster in the past to enable the cluster to become a learning organization. Now, in this regard, I think it's quite important to note that there are members of the cluster who are studying at the very universities that are members of HISA. Members of the police, the intelligence services, the military. So if we have a protection of state information bill that impacts on negatively on academic freedom, it impacts on the ability of those very individuals to be able to pursue their studies freely, which in turn, I think, could impact negatively on the cluster itself. Now, I think there's no doubt in our minds that the Protection of State Information Bill is needed, and that because the apartheid-era Protection of Information Act of 1982 is anachronistic, there's no doubt that it's unconstitutional and needs to be repealed from the statute books. Also, the minimum information security standards that are enforced at the moment are problematic for reasons that I think we're all aware of, and they should not continue to remain in force. But I think some of the problems are that the declassification procedures remain complex and vague, as Ken has pointed out. And this will mean that academics will not be able to plan their research very easily. As a period for determining requests for classified information will be within an undefined reasonable time. Now, researchers will have to confirm with classification authorities whether the information they glean from public sources is classified or not. Otherwise, they face imprisonment for obtaining, holding, researching, or publishing classified information. And this will inevitably have a chilling effect on research and hence on academic freedom. Now, since the application, review, and appeals process for access to information has been restricted to those officials and line ministers who classified the information in the first place, it may be nigh impossible to obtain such information, especially on the type of controversial projects that require review. Now, the bill also doesn't protect researchers who manage to obtain the information from employees working in these areas. While the whistleblower is protected from prosecution for disclosure, the researcher can face imprisonment for a term ranging from 5 to 25 years. Now, I think we accept that there is information that needs to be protected from disclosure on national security grounds. But we feel that as a general rule, this information should be limited to operational information, whose disclosure would present a clear threat to the safety of the citizenry and people working in the cluster. Also, as a general rule, policy-related and strategic information, which by its very nature requires more debate, because it often involves complex trade-offs between competing priorities, should be in the public domain. However, the still overbroad definition of national security lends itself to overclassification of both operational and strategic information, as does the provision around bulk classification and the inadequate review and appeal mechanisms. And for us, the combined effects of these problems is that teaching and research on the security cluster is likely to be frustrated, which will make it difficult for academia to play the role that it needs to. Several universities undertake research and offer courses on strategic studies, and they will be the most heavily affected. Researchers and lecturers may shy away from studying current issues concerning the security cluster, as the information needed to undertake this work will be difficult to access. Now, these problems could also lead to teaching and research becoming detached from events taking place in the security cluster. Knowledge production about strategic issues facing the cluster and the role of the police, intelligence sector, and the military in society will become more difficult. So research, for instance, that is of considerable public importance, such as research into the restructuring and the remilitarization of the police and its relationship to growing police violence, and research into the transformation of the military will be extremely difficult to undertake. Researchers will also find it extremely difficult to inquire into whether the intelligence services are being used to ensure civilian safety rather than the harassment of political opposition, a concern that is occupying the minds of many citizens. Now, universities have a role to play in democratizing knowledge to improve society. If they cannot obtain access to information necessary to generate this knowledge, then society as a whole will be poorer for it. And a secretive security cluster, sealed up from public scrutiny, is dangerous. World history is littered with examples of intelligence officials, police and military personnel who have abused their power when secrecy prevails over transparency. Furthermore, if academics cannot access information about the cluster readily, then crucial lessons to be learnt from problems that have arisen in the cluster cannot be analysed, which may deny the intelligence, military, and police crucial opportunities to learn from past mistakes. A security cluster that is not informed by debate about its priorities and activities can quickly become inward-focusing and out of touch with reality. It may fail to address key social problems, or it may address them inappropriately. Now, my concluding statement is that we recognise that the bill has come a long way from its earlier iterations, but we feel that if the proposed amendments are taken into account, then these improvements can also be built on. And we would also be quite keen to explore with the committee the possibilities of researchers being able to access classified information other than through the declassification process, which, as we've described, can be extremely time-consuming and is problematic on several levels. And if the opportunity provides itself, then we would be quite keen to supplement our submission if there's a possibility to do so on this particular issue. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Honourable Number, there's the presentation. Honourable Wood.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, my question is to Professor Shane Duncan. On page 9 of your submission, the second paragraph there says, just after 2, says, there is no doubt that the protection of valuable information from loss, destruction, or alteration, and the classification of information concerning national security and the regulation of access thereto are constitutionally defensible. There is a school of thought, excuse the pun, but there is a school of thought that says valuable information, most of the valuable information is archives, archival evidence, which rests in the provinces, and it says this is a provincial competency, and therefore this is not constitutionally acceptable. Could I have your comments on that, please? Thank you.
Honourable Motoke.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Could today please find for us what they mean by strategic information relating to strategic matters? And secondly, Chair, if they decide to embark on new research, and the research that requires classified information, what harm will it cause to them to go and seek that information from the court? And with reference to the delay, if you embark on a research, you know when you should complete that research. For instance, you can't be expected to complete a research in December and request information in November. You have to know how long your research is going to take and what information you are going to need. More especially with regard to the information that is classified. I think from the onset you will know that it will take you time to get that information. So it will not be on the part of the state to cause the delay, but the person who wants that information should apply timelessly to have that information. Thank you very much.
Honourable Timande.
Thank you, Chair. The issue of classification, access to classified information, Chair, I think if they could clarify, you see, if you are, or first, let me start this way, Chair. They are presenting their research as purely academic. And we are all aware of the instances, and we know that some of these researchers from these institutions, Chair, they are commercially commissioned as well. So what balance they think must be struck between that interest
of commercially commissioned research. And then also, Chair, I'm not sure. I hear that they talk of not they want an option, that they can talk of an option of not going through the process of declassifying, but they want direct access to classify the information. Now, Chair, with academic institutions, they are supposed to then reference and quote on their work. It's not just writing an opinion and don't reference and say, you know, where you got the information and even how is the information kept. So I'm trying to understand this kind of request, Chair. And in their view, in some of the issues, whether they're talking exemption, total exemption, on their access to classified information. But Chair, without the benefit of having read the submission, the issue of the normal route of FIA, promotion of access to information, whether they see any limitations in using that route, because that route still that act still provides those option of accessing information. It still preserves the right to access. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, let me first say that Section 237 of the Constitution talks of constitutional obligation that must be performed diligently and without delay. I am quoting this, saying that in the bill we have Section 90. And the presenter, the first presenter, was talking about the process that should be quick. You know, the process must be as quickly as possible. And he was saying it is not a reasonable time. Now, Section 19 text talks about the first 14 days and then the 30 days. I'm not going to go into that. I think he has read that. Does the presenter think that 30 days is unreasonable? Or, I mean, the 14 days and the 30 days separately, are they unreasonable? And if so, what is his suggestion? Because it really worries me as if we are not confined to our constitution. And having said that, my other concern is on the research. The way the research, academia research, was explained here today, to me, because we believe that in this bill, when we talk of classified information, we are confining ourselves to the Chapter 11 institution. Now, my worry, the way it was brought here, is as if these researchers, in the academic researchers, I tend to be investigators. Now I have a problem. Are they researching or are they investigating the way it was brought here? And is the higher education SE, as presented by you, Ken, aware of where we confine this classified information under, which is Chapter 11 institution? And let me say that sometimes things that are said here tend to paint us, and we don't defend ourselves. You know, I wouldn't want to be looked at as one person who's accusing people in here. The first statement he said before he is accused of going overboard. We never accused anybody. And once it goes out, it's as if we are accusing people. We are not accusing. You are here to assist us. That is why we come to you for clarity. Please, let's refrain from such chatterton, because going out, it paints us very black. Thank you, chatterton.
Thank you, Chair. We must emphasize on the last part of the narrative. I thought we are here not to be charged or judged. So we must really leave each other the way we all found each other. But, Chair, my question will be for clarity. I do, from the presenter, the first presenter, well, I want to know why should foreign intellectuals have a right to criticize the government? Why should they be afforded that? It came across like she was saying that, and if the other lady couldn't respond as well, because she had a chance or she would have a conversation. I thought, like today, matters that are in the public library are accessed by all people. And definitely we still speak of classified information only. That would not be in a public library, but there was the processes. And I don't think the bill seeks to take away all those rights, because I think it has to do with rights today. And just from the other lady, I want to know how different is academic freedom from other freedom. You see, I want to make this example check when I have some questions. Here in Parliament we have a committee on joint standing committee. We have a committee that's called Joint Standing Committee on Inheritance. Unlike all committees, that committee, its meetings are in closed sessions all the time. And that's the requirement of the Constitution, not just by rules of Parliament only. The sensitive matters that are discussed in that committee really require them not to have public meetings. And if matters are going to be of public nature, like we are dealing with issues of security, state security now, it has to be this committee so that the public can participate, and such are always afforded. So I do want to correct the fact that people are not afforded time or opportunities to engage. It's not true and it is not true. I thought, in departments and ministries, researchers become part of the drafters of a particular bill. So there will be no way that all academia would always be barred from information as it is suggested. And last to say, we must also correct something, even amongst ourselves as members of Parliament. Issues of state security are not issues that are a function of any province. So we should also not suggest to you that we should even begin to look at whether it should not have been a provincial level. We are one country, one state, one nation with provinces for administrative purposes. And I thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you very much, and thank you for the presentation. I just want to know what your experience is with respect to research currently, and compare that with what is in the bill. Of course, you've already outlined the challenges in the bill, because we would like to know what the current experience is, so that we can be better informed. The second question relates to the issue of registration of foreign agents. Don't you think that it would assist government to manage the coming in of foreign spies into the country, so that at least they can be able to manage that situation? And of course, I know that they are doing their own work, you know, to identify some of the people who are in the country generally, who may be involved in the work of espionage. I know that. But why are you concerned about that? Indeed, because I would not understand why. The third question relates to, you know, you have outlined the all the rights that are contained in the Bill of Rights, etc., etc. And I'm looking at Section 36 of the Constitution, and perhaps wanting to know to what extent would government regulate with respect to Section 36, and because we are obliged to really make sure that we manage and we balance information such that we don't become a reckless country, so to speak, insofar as the management of information is concerned. I'll really want to find out to what extent, because given the proposals now, which you concerned about, and thank you very much, Chairperson. Thank you.
Bloom.
Thank you very much, Chairperson.
You mean out of order, next media. Chairperson, let me first thank Higher Education South Africa for this very good presentation. You know, out of this chat, we are learning a lot of things. Each and every presenter is coming with some knowledge, except for the other one. But I'm not going to go into that one. But we are learning a lot from Higher Education as well. Let me pose my question. Chairperson, how will this bill affect the human research the council and the people who are doing the research? Can you please research council, yeah, human research, yeah. Can you please help us with that one? And then on page 18 is saying that your recommendation limits the classification to state security organs and capital letters without the opt-in clause. Can you maybe explain that one? And then on page 27, again, is your recommendation. Recommendation 2 is that you are saying the process of automated declassification of apartheid era classified documents, as was in 28th vision of the bill. Can you maybe give more clarity on that one? What do you mean by that? Thank you very much, Ken.
Thank you,
Lord.
Thank you,
sir. The just areas that they face. I can make mention of particularly regard to Section 41, and I fail to understand how did you arrive at those conclusions that you are arriving at.
For an example, you are saying here that research into court proceedings and critique of court judgment is made impossible by this particular court, especially in those cases where evidence and judgment relied on by the court in reaching their conclusion are classified. This is because the court are broke, the real court are broken. Those evidences in their judgment. Now, then you are reflecting the current, the current scenario, which nobody has got a problem with. But now I don't understand how you now then take that which you don't have a problem with all the years and begin to link it to this particular deal. I want to understand how you do that. And then the next point is to where you say researchers and children from foreign countries have now been exposed to unreasonable suspicion and intimidation by Section 41.
Now, if you read Section 41, it does not talk of foreign students. And if I may read it for you, it says any person who is in the Republic and who is employed or operating as an agent for a foreign intelligence or security service, or not employed or operating as an agent for foreign intelligence or a security service, but is in the Republic with the expectation of potential of activation or reactivation as an agent of certain intelligence or security service, must register. Now, you are talking about foreign students in the country who might be subjected to harassment by the security law agencies and so on and so forth. And then you make reference to that to Section 41. I'm not sure if the Section 41 that you are reading that talks of students is the same one that I've read. But if it's the same one that I've read, then I would want you to explain to us as to where do the students fit into this, because Subsection 2 also is still talk of any person who fails to register. And you can't read Section 2 in isolation with Section 1 and its subsections. That's how I understand the law to be read. So, but I'm sure you'll be able to explain. You also go further to say South Africa has a story history of abuse of state security apparatus, and universities have a key role to play to ensure that such abuses are not repeated. That statement now begins to make me feel like I no longer understand the role of university, not only in South Africa, but elsewhere in the world. If you could elaborate further on that so that I have a proper understanding of what exactly you mean by that statement.
I will stop there, Chair.
Another answer?
I think I'm covered by Honorable Mazosiwe and Honorable Tanya on Section 41, because I was also of the opinion of Section 41, what is Section 41 to do with the academic?
No, thanks, Honorable Members. Maybe just to avoid coming back later. You know, yesterday, I've been trying to check on my notebook and I can't find the name of the organization that made the presentation. In actual fact, they had a problem to the effect that they were saying they were worried about the definition of the head of organ of state. And in that worry, they then drawn our attention to the Constitution and how it defines institutions of higher learning as an organ of state, and therefore also drawn our attention to the fact that by virtue of head of organ of state having the right to classify or declassify. Therefore, it will also affect even institutions of higher learning where the head of the institution will also classify and declassify information, and in the process hamper the development of the academic facility, so much that students or researchers in institutions of higher learning would not even have access to information in the institutions of higher learning. It would be good to get your opinion on that. Do you see yourself as institutions of higher learning as as organs of state that would have the right to classify or declassify information, and therefore confirm your same worry that you have? That's point number one. Point number two, I still want to know where in the world does or do the academia have the right to do research on classified or secret, state secrets? Where in the world? I want somebody to open my mind on that. And yesterday I made an example of a group of students from the University of Colombia. I like this Colombian. Chicago. From Chicago, who were on an exchange program in South Africa 3 weeks ago, who were with their rector, professor. And I asked them the question, whether if they care, in terms of the legislation of the United States of America, can they do research on the West that is done by the CIA? And they said no. Now, why in South Africa are we supposed to do that? To allow research work to be done on classified state security information. I want to be specific. Classified state security information. And if you can really give me an example of two countries in the world where such is happening. And linked to that is to then assist us also as a committee to say, if then we are convinced as a committee to say, okay, we are of the opinion that the academia must be given such an opportunity to do research on classified state security information, for instance. How then do you now as a sector see yourself protecting that information to remain classified when in actual fact that research work is going to be published? If you are given an opportunity to do that that research work. And last thing, if you were to convince us, and we get convinced, in relation to listening to what you're saying, and we feel that no, we can't suffocate the academic capacity or the academia in South Africa from growth, development, and broadening the knowledge base of our country. If we decide, okay, fine, and the committee will feel strongly that we can't suffocate that sector, we need to create space. Where in this bill do you think we need to improve in order to allow that to happen? I think that would assist us as well as a committee when we consider all the issues that we're raising.
Is it our turn to respond, Mr. Shannon?
Yes?
Is it our turn to respond?
Yes.
I'll let the presenters speak. And I'll just pick up 2 points, if I may, before they speak. The one was your First to say, it's really a very challenging level of discussion and debate, and we appreciate that too. We appreciate how seriously these views are being taken by your committee, and the points raised are profound and challenging points. The first that I will respond to is the question you raised about organs of state and heads of organs of state, because I've never thought of myself as the head of an organ of state, but it's quite a flattering position to be in. But I think that we recognize that there are certainly some interpretations that do include public universities as organs of state. We had debates about whether that raised any particular problems for us because of how organs of state come into this poll. And our view was that ultimately, although the bill would make it possible, and of course it's restricted to Chapter 11, to issues of the agencies of security, that this isn't a significant risk, because the universities, the heads of universities are the protectors of all of those values, of academic freedom, of the need to do research. And so it seems to us that even though they might have that power in terms of the bill, they would be, we can't really imagine a situation where they would use it. Moreover, the heads of these institutions are in fact accountable downwards and upwards. In almost every institution, for example, the renewal of a traditional appointment requires the support of the majority of the Senate and of the Council of the University. And so one would anticipate that if this was out of line with the views of a university, that it would not take long before such a person is removed and a new head of the organ of state in place, and presumably then revoking such control. So that's why we haven't felt it necessary to address specifically. It seems an unlikely situation. The other issue that I want to pick up is the question which has come up several times about the Section 41 reference to foreigners and potentially foreign agents. And I think our concern is this. At many universities, particularly at the postgraduate level, and the University of Cape Town is an example, there are roughly, of all of the postgraduate students, roughly a third are from outside of the country, international students, which we're very proud of. It means that the universities are international hubs of research, and this percentage is probably even higher in areas of strategic studies and international relations, where the very purpose and mechanism of research in those areas depends on having a whole lot of international input and having the perspective of scientists and researchers from different countries, often who work very closely with their own agencies. And our concern is that this is too broad, because it says that someone under Section 41, someone who an international student or a foreign student who is in the country, and as we said, we have no problem with the first part of the clause where they're already employed or they're identified or they're sent here or they might be planning to become re-employed in a foreign intelligence agency. Clearly, those people must register. But the looseness is in the second part of the clause, which says that even if they're not so employed, if the government thinks they might be or they could be, then they must register or they are illegal. Now, it would not be unusual for someone studying in a South African university in an international relations or strategic studies or military studies department from another place to have that suspicion over their head then, because of the subject that they study and the interest that they're expressing. And we're saying that would not only make it very uncomfortable and maybe impossible, because of the risk they would run for such students to embark on those studies or to come to South Africa to embark on those studies. It will have a negative and chilling effect on the whole process of research in those areas. So that was my response just to that particular question, and then I'd like to hand over to the others to pick up the other issues.
Thank you, Chair. I think the first point I want to make is that the point I made at the end of my presentation about me being accused of being overbroad was made in a light note. It was more of a warning to myself that I should not exceed the time limit that we have set for ourselves. That if it didn't reach out like that, then I stand corrected. Yeah, sorry for that. I think I will respond to some of the legal issues that were raised, and then my colleague will also come in to touch on the issues that I've left out. One of the issues that has been raised by one of the honorable members is the fact that in research, generally academic research, a student is expected to plan for his work. And so that if you know that your research is going to take 1 year, then you're supposed to plan in advance on when to apply and when you expect to get that information. We are saying that we don't have a problem in that. The problem that we have is the way Section 19 is phrased. Section 19 is saying that if you are applying for access to classified information that does not meet the requirements of either being a breach of the law or being a threat to public health or environment risk, then the period for consideration of your application will be reasonable time. And you're saying that as long as the bill leaves that term to reasonable time, you cannot plan with reasonable time. And so we are saying that the only way to help a researcher plan is to make that period determinate. We have proposed in our written document that the period should be 30 days maximum, so that at least we know that if I apply in January, by February I should get the information. Or if I don't get, at least I should have a feedback from the organ of state that we have applied to. The second thing that I want to talk about is the fact that let me talk to the issue of whether a university is an organ of state, and Dr. Price has talked about it. But if you look at the law as it is framed now, the law is saying that all organs of state actually have a duty to classify, not classify information, but to protect valuable information. So all organs of state have been given a duty by the bill to protect valuable information. When it comes to classification of information, it has been restricted to those in the security class. But the issue that we have is that there is that clause that provides for what we call an opt-in, so that if an organ of state feels like they want to hide information, or that there's some information that the members of the public should not get access to, then they have been given the option to apply to the minister. And on establishing good cause, the minister has been given the power to either admit these organs of state to also be members of the classifying community. And we are saying that that opt-in clause in itself can be abused. It can be abused by organs of state that are hell-bent on hiding information. It can be abused on the ground that the issue of good cause in itself is not determinate. And so it's left overbroadly to the discretion of the minister to determine whether good cause has been established or not. And so we are saying that let that opt-in clause be deleted and let us restrict classification of state information to security agencies. There is the issue of research into court decisions. And it's one of the issues that we have been grappling with under Section 55.1, to believe, 52 rather. The bill is trying to regulate the way classified information will be dealt with during a court process. And it is saying that in those instances where the information that is required reveals matters of national security, then the court should apply some discretion. And, for example, provide for an in-camera type of hearing so as to protect that information. we have no problem with that. We are saying that in such an instance, it's actually for the protection of the safety of the citizens, the court should actually exclude some information from being heard by members of the public. The issue that we have is that the implication of that, if it's left the way it is that eventually when a decision is made by the court and a court comes up with a judgment, that the court can actually make a conclusion on the basis of a document whose content it does not include in the judgment. And this has happened in Kenya, where a court says that having looked at the classified information that I was given by the minister, I'm satisfied that the ground for refusal of entry into the country has been satisfied. And so we are saying that for a researcher who is critiquing a court judgment and who is left with no ground in the judgment that the court based its decision on, it becomes very difficult to criticize a court judgment. And so what will happen is that if you want to criticize that, then you'll have to apply to court, yeah, for access to the information that they used to reach the conclusion that they did. And because of the time constraint involved, we are saying that that is overburdening an academician, especially legal researchers who are trying to make judges excellent in their judicial decision. And then there is also the issue of I think it was raised by the honourable member about the fact that it is assumed that information that is in the public library is already in the public domain, and therefore a person who accesses that information, really the bill will not touch. But in our reading of the bill, the way the bill is phrased, it is such that the bill is saying that if you knowingly access classified information, if you knowingly access classified information and you use that information for publication, then you are liable for a crime. That is what the bill is saying. The thing is that if I get into a library, and we were just discussing it today in the morning, there was this document that was presented before the committee by the Security Services Agency. And at the end of the presentation, it was a PowerPoint presentation, it was written confidential. Yeah, there was that part. I think it was just being done for the sake of it. It was not meant to be confidential, but it was written like that. And so I meet such a document in the library, a public library. It is written confidential. If I possess that information, or if I use that information, the bill is now saying that I'll be liable for punishment because I knowingly possess a classified information. And so the bill is putting pressure on the academician to confirm from the organ of state whether the information that I have found marked classified is actually classified or not. And so we are saying that the only way to remove that burden from members of the academia is to introduce the public domain defense. That once the host has bolted and the information is out there, then that information should be treated as compromised. Let the security agencies go to the people who need the information and not people who subsequently use that information. That is our argument. And then I want to leave there. Maybe I might pick up more issues and allow my colleagues to also touch on some of the things that were raised.
I think the first question that I want to start with is the question about the status quo when it comes to research, because I think that will set the context for responses that I'll make to subsequent questions. So what is the status quo with respect to research under the minimum information security standards? Well, it's quite a complex picture, and I'll deal with the military, the police, and the intelligence separately. And maybe just to dispense with one question that was raised earlier about are we, you know, labouring under the impression that the classification aspects of the bill relate to organs of state other than the security organs. No, we aren't labouring under that impression. We're very clear that unless opt-in is allowed, classification will apply to the police, the military, and the intelligence services. Now, what researchers have often tended to find under the minimum information security standards is a culture of overclassification. There's also a hierarchy of researchers that has developed, where senior researchers who have developed, who built trust relationships over time, and who have those personal relationships, can get access to information a lot more easy, a lot easier than junior researchers who still have to build up those relationships. So a lot depends on personal relationships. But having said that, even the most senior researchers on aspects of the security cluster have found a culture of overclassification. In fact, there's one researcher from Stellenbosch University who works on the military strategic studies, who's even found newspaper articles being classified by virtue of bulk classification. So if a particular category of information is classified, then the newspaper reports in relation to that particular category of information are also classified as well. Also in relation to the military as well, there is another senior academic at Stellenbosch University who's been attempting to undertake research into HIV/AIDS prevalence in the military. And she's been unable to access statistics around HIV/AIDS prevalence in the military. And what she's observed about this is that the military is one of the few institutions that tests for HIV/AIDS on an annual basis. And if members of the military are preparing for combat, then they're tested on a six-monthly basis. Now, she found that that kind of information that could yield potentially very rich data about whether the HIV/AIDS pandemic is growing or declining in the country, data that would be extremely difficult to access from other sources, is classified. And because of that, she's had to rely on death statistics in order to plot the trends around HIV/AIDS in the military. Also, across all three sectors, researchers have tended to find that research into the culture in the police, the military, and the intelligence is extremely important. So, for instance, you know, one form of research that has been attempted to be undertaken is around what's generally termed the remilitarization of the police, the introduction of the military ranking system into the police. And is there a causal relationship between that and the instances that we've seen of police violence against civilians and protesters? So they're attempting to understand that particular link. They have found, certainly over the past 2 to 3 years, that that kind of ethnographic work that involves actually getting into the police or getting into the military and doing observational work has become exceedingly difficult, and there certainly are fears that it's going to become even more difficult once the bill is promulgated into law. In relation to the police, policing researchers have noticed a closing up of space in relation to policing research, and are finding it more and more difficult to access the information that they need. And in relation to the intelligence services, little research work is actually taking place in relation to the intelligence services. There's no national network of researchers that's in existence on the intelligence sector. And because of that, you know, there's also a fear on the part of the few researchers who are active on intelligence matters that it's going to be as difficult, if not more difficult, once the space information bill is passed into law, in spite of the fact that the minimum information security standards, the criteria for accessing, for the classification of information, the minimum information security standards are a lot looser and a lot more problematic than the criteria in the bill. Now, just in relation to the question about strategic information, what do I mean about strategic information relative to operational information? Well, you know, strategic information for me is information about key macro decisions that need to be taken, about how, for instance, the military are going to be deployed. Let's say the role of the military in relation to peacekeeping on the continent. That would be a strategic issue. It requires debate. It also requires research as well. And those kinds of strategic documents that deal with the big picture, that deal with the fundamental questions of the direction of aspects of the security cluster, are documents that need to be freely available. For instance, there's no obvious reason why the strategic intelligence assessments and the priorities of the intelligence services should not be in the public domain, because that's really about how intelligence resources are being deployed in the country. And that requires debate, because perhaps there are different understandings in the country about how these resources need to be deployed, which in turn depends on how we rate the extent of the threat to the country. And we can only really get to a proper understanding of what the potential security problems are and how to address those problems through debate, through maximum openness in relation to that level of decision making. But as we pointed out in the presentation, we think that there's a strong argument to be made for operational information that actually puts strategic and policy decisions into practice, aspects of operational information to be kept secret, particularly if it relates to the safety of intelligence and police forces and their families. There's very strong arguments to be made there. So I think the general rule needs to be that if there is a very clear harm that will flow from operational information being made available, then there's grounds to protect that particular category, those particular categories of information. Just going back to the question of strategic information as a principle being available, we also think that information relating to policy should also be freely available as well, and we think that the bill will be failing South Africa if in fact it fails to provide for policy and strategic documents to come into the public domain. So for instance, policies within the State Security Agency around the use of intrusive methods of surveillance. What are the circumstances under which it could be justifiable for intrusive methods of surveillance to be used against people in society? Those are the strategic issues that we need to have in the public domain. We know, for instance, the circumstances under which the interception of communications can take place, because that's set out in RICO. But in relation to other aspects of the use of intrusive methods of surveillance, we don't know, because that information isn't readily available, and that's the kind of information that would be of interest to researchers on the security cluster. And are we straying into work that we shouldn't be straying into by doing this kind of research? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. Because, as I said, I think that research as well could potentially, it's got many roles to play in society, but potentially it could also assist even yourself to play the oversight role that's necessary in order to hold the sector to account. So, for instance, it must surely be of interest to Parliament, for instance, what is taking place with respect to the policing culture subsequent to the adoption of the military ranking system. It would help you, surely, as parliamentarians, to be able to gain some kind of insight into that particular issue. So I don't think that we are straying into areas of work that we shouldn't be straying into. On the contrary, if we are going to have a socially relevant and socially engaged academia, then we need to have as free and as open an interaction with the security cluster as possible, but not in a way that that compromises national security. And as I've said, we do recognize the fact that there are grounds on which information should be protected. On the question of apartheid-era documents and what we meant by them being declassified, well, you know, given that documents that were classified under the Protection of Information Act, the 1982 Act and the Minimum Information Security Standards, will be carried over, if you like, into the Protection of State Information Bill regime, and then systematically interrogated for whether they should be declassified or not, that may take a tremendous amount of time. And there's also an argument that's also, you know, recognized to an extent in the bill as well, that the older information becomes, the less sensitive it becomes. And I think it's really in the interests of being able to interrogate and understand our past and understand the lessons from our past that as much information should be made available as possible, as quickly as possible, so that researchers can attempt to draw those particular lessons. If you have problems with the arguments around the automatic declassification of that information, then one of the alternative positions that could be considered is that a time frame could be included in the bill. And we would suggest a time frame of 2 years, so that the period of review of classified documents under those particular documents would be specifically time bound. In relation to the points that we have flagged around why we've raised the possibility of seeking direct access to classified information. It's really on the understanding that the only way that we are going to be able to get to the deeper levels of analysis that I spoke about in my presentation is if there is a free flow of information as possible on what is taking place in the security cluster. And direct access would obviously facilitate that. But I did mention in my contribution that this is an idea that we're raising that we'd like to explore with the committee, and we would also like an opportunity to supplement our submission on this particular issue, because there's various ways of skinning this particular cat to address, I think, the problems that were implicit in the question that was raised. So, for instance, if free access is allowed to classified information, then one possibility is to make the classification review panel responsible for reviewing the publishable nature of that particular research. The other possibility is to subject researchers to security clearance before they get access to classified documents. So I think there are a variety of ways, and if we do have the opportunity to supplement our submissions to explore those particular possibilities, including whether there are international precedents that allow this kind of thing to happen, then we'd certainly like to do that. how different is academic freedom from other freedoms? I'm not entirely sure if I understood the question, but I'll give it a bash. Academic freedom is protected under freedom of expression as a subsection of freedom of expression. And as with other rights, if it comes into conflict with other rights, then obviously the court will need to engage in a balancing exercise to decide on the basis of particular cases which rights would give way. Obviously, academic freedom as an instance of freedom of expression is subject to the internal limitations around categories of speech that don't receive constitutional protection, and also it's subject to the general limitations clause, as Ken mentioned earlier. So I don't think we're making arguments for academic freedom as some kind of special freedom that should stand above the law or should stand above society. That's not the argument, I think, that we're making.
Okay, no. Follow-ups, 2, 3, 4. We're talking, followed by Chani, followed by Groom, followed by Tadizuman.
Thank you very much, Chair. I am perturbed by what the gentleman said about the information, the classified information, finds itself in the public domain. It should be considered compromised. What is his opinion about the consequences of that disclosure? He put it nicely that if the horse has bolted, you know, but in real life situation, if the horse has bolted, what will be the consequences with regard to the disclosure of that sensitive information? If, maybe for an example, it leads our country to a war, should we just say the horse has bolted, and then we find ourselves in a situation where our country is attacked or is at war?
No, thanks, Chair. Chair, the first point, listening to the last response on the question, I would definitely also say it's my view that somehow CISA is in the territory where it's supposed not to come. Unless, of course, your examples are better. Let's take an example of anybody wanting to do research in the army, the one that is to check the level of HIV prevalence. And then when you are told that information is classified, then it appears to be a problem. It's because to me, anybody doing that is tantamount to actually wanting to determine the strength of that particular army. You can debate that point. So you went on to the next other example, which is, I just missed a bit, but I'm saying some of these things are justified, of course, for security reasons, if you are to do that particular kind of example. Hence my comment. But the point I want to come to change, the point made by Dr. Hagen, with regard to Section 61. You see, we need to appreciate the fact that what they really do here, it recognizes the fact that in this country, there are people who are agents of foreign intelligence or security services, employed, but doing their work in this country. And we seek to say, the ability to say, they need to be, we need to know those people, they must be registered. Even those who will come in the future. Now, B, where I suspect you're placing your children. The bill recognizes that some are former agents or employees of security services. in foreign countries. Good idea, but who giving any sense we can activate their skills in that line? And it simply says we need to know those, they must register themselves, because already some of them are known. Now, let's take the children. Your presentation now brings another dimension to me, that there's high possibility that there are other agents or employees of security services from foreign countries who are in this country as students. And now, as Gita, you say, no, no, no. Now you are making it difficult for these people to be our children, because you want them to register. Yes, if they were agents, whether they are here as students or as ordinary employees, as they can be or whatever, they must register. We need to know them, for obvious reasons. I don't even have to get into the details as to why we should register. But the fact of the matter is that we don't have to, that they should lose lots of resources tracing who is here to do what in the country. But we are saying those who are, if their intention of being in the country, let alone their skills and experiences from where they come from, are genuine. They are here to get education from our universities, and they have forgotten about them being former employees of them. Then they should not hide. But the reality is that as we are democracy, the experiences that we have seen, some of us begin to understand the relevance of this clause. And it should not be for them, unless of course, as Lisa, you want to say to us, no, 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 no. Those agents or employees of the security who are in this country, who are not employed, and who happen to be students, should be excluded from all these things that they are going to do. Then I would personally have a problem with that, and I hope that is not what you are suggesting. But I would want to get your view on that particular point two, I have already indicated that you can you should always read it in conjunction with one area, because you can't isolate the two. But at least as Lisa, you must recognize those kind of realities in the country, insofar as such people exist now in this country. And some of them are found in universities, some of them are found in companies elsewhere in the country. Some of them are just there, not employed anywhere, but coming here as they are province or people who want second citizenship, but knowing very well the intention why they are in this country. I think.
Thank you very much. A short follow up, declassification of information. The sensitive, very sensitive information that the state is sitting with. Are you saying that even what Dr. Voter Basson has done, the flight crash of Samora Machel must be open? Is that what you are saying? It's very sensitive information. Thank you.
Yeah, Chair, I've asked a question around that, because they are arguing for free access. And I said that Bahia, what do they have? Are there problems that they have with Bahia in accessing information? And then linked, now as a follow-up, because they didn't answer that, what is the understanding of visa on the limitation clause? And now, thirdly, Chair, I thought that the doctor was going to answer my question on Dr. Price on, you see, on, I raised a question of, you see, when you get classified information, top secret, let's say they have access. Now, there are standard requirements for research where you disclose sources, references, and all that. That is also not answered. Now, the other one, Chair, is relating to commercial research, because some of these researchers that they are arguing for, the research might be commissioned commercially, even, I mean, even this one of the HIV, somebody might want to get business with the military, not even for security, whatever, check assessment of strength of the army, but someone wants to do some kind of business, commercial business, after the research results. So I'm saying we need to hear them on those things, because they are arguing for open access or free access to classification in the manner they've argued this afternoon. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you very much. You may respond to those few questions.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, members. So on the clause 41, section 41, just to try to be precise about the objection, clearly we understand that there might be people who masquerade as students who are in fact spies, and that the law should not tolerate that. The law should not make exceptions for them. They should be obliged to register. That isn't what we're talking about. But it's really just two words that we would like to see deleted, and they're the words "or potential." So the clause says any person who is in the Republic and who is not employed, not operating as an agent, but is in the Republic with the expectation, now that's fine, if they have the expectation, they should have to register. And then it says, or potential of activation. Now, anyone who is here in the country, who comes from a foreign state, who has some interest in international relations, strategic studies, has the potential to be activated as an agent of a foreign intelligence agency. It is so broad that, and then the clause 2 says, of course, they're liable to an offence in imprisonment. It seems to me that that is so broad that any student who is here would be quite anxious, because if they did something wrong, if they spoke up against the government, they exercised freedom of speech or academic freedom, or wrote an article that was critical or exposed something, then they could easily be accused for doing the same thing as some other student has done under the same research conditions. They could be accused of not having registered and therefore going to prison. So if all we would like to see there is that the all potential is deleted, because it just seems far too broad for us. The second point, second question referenced to me was the issue about the nature of research needing to make reference to sources, and often through bibliographies or through references, and therefore that by accessing classified information to do research, that information automatically becomes declassified, and therefore what is the point, I think, is that's the sense of the question. Well, I think that researchers and universities are comfortable with and familiar with doing work that has to be kept confidential. For example, someone mentioned commercial research. We do research for companies that are investigating new pharmaceutical drugs. Those drugs are going to be patented. The information, the molecular structures, have to be kept secret, often for several years, in order for the intellectual property to be protected and exploited. In fact, we have done for many years research for Danel and for the arms corps and for the arms industry. That research had to be kept confidential and not disclosed. So this is not a completely new idea, and there are a number of ways of addressing this need to reference it. Sometimes the research can be published with results that do not have to reference all the sources, as long as there is some sort of peer review to validate the fact that the research has been properly done. Often it is possible to write the research in a way that doesn't compromise the security, and that's why the suggestion was made that the review panel might reserve the right to decide whether the research can ultimately be published or not in the public domain. It might be that the research only goes back to the intelligence agency, and that it isn't in the public domain because it's useful for the strategic intelligence and military to have that information. But many researchers would say, I think, apply their good sense. They would say it's important that this gets into the public domain. I know it can't possibly go into the public domain if I make reference or if I quote this source and this source and this source. So they will find a way of writing research which doesn't need to make reference or doesn't draw on it, or make reference and simply says these sources are confidential and can't be disclosed. If that means that you don't trust my work, then don't trust it. But this is the basis of why I've drawn certain conclusions. So I think that we have quite a lot of experience with doing that sort of work, and this would not be impossible. In other words, the summary of that is classified information does not automatically become declassified just because it is the subject of research, and even whether or not that research is published. I think that, I'm not sure if I understood the point about commercial research and why the distinction is drawn between commercial research and, I suppose, investigator-driven research or public research. Commercial research, I suppose, is usually research which is commissioned by a company and is going to benefit, maybe benefit a company or promote profits or promote private information. If that information is going to be kept confidential, then I don't think that there's any obligation on the state to reveal something that's going to be confidential to a private individual or a private company. But the mechanism needs to be there to be able to scrutinize individual applications. There will be some research, and I'd like to come back to the HIV in the military as an example. There will be some research which will be contested. Some would say you should not research HIV in the military because that will reveal the weakness of the army. And it may well be the case that the authorities say that can't be done. At the moment, however, there is no mechanism to do that at all, because if the information is classified, it can't be researched, can't be used. However, I think that that would be, as I said, that would be contested, and the army might say to us, actually, that's very interesting information. We would like you to do the research. We would like you to do it for us. At the moment, that a researcher who does not have the ability, there isn't anything in the Act that allows that information to be made available since it's classified, and it can't then. Now, the question which I'm going to duck, because perhaps I'm not accurate here, is around the Protection of Access to Information Act, and whether that might offer researchers some avenue into this. My information was that it didn't, but I'm going to defer to my colleagues to help us answer that question.
I'll respond to two questions. One is on the issue of public domain defense. The Honorable Member is raising the issue whether we should sit back if information has already gotten out there that is dangerous to the security of the public. And we are saying that, yes, you should. Because given the technological advances that the world has made so far, once information gets out there to the public, it is spread in the internet. Let us give the example of WikiLeaks. It was embarrassing to Americans, but there is nothing that they could have done. And so that is why they could not punish people who use that information to publish, let's say, news, for example. And so we are saying that if you are going to restrict South Africans from accessing information that is already in the public domain, then you are going to disadvantage them compared to nationals out there who still have access to that information through the net. And so we are saying that the only way we can make academic work is if we introduce the public domain defense, so that once the information gets out there, you can't get it back. People have it already. So that the only thing that you can do is to get to those people who actually leaked the information and punish those people. But once it gets out there, it's our humble argument that you cannot punish people who eventually uses that information that is already in the public. And the second thing is about the relationship between AIA and the field, and whether we are at HESA recommending that that information that will help in academic research should be freely given to us. Actually, we are not. We are not saying that information should be given to us freely. What we are saying, and it's an argument that we raised earlier on, is that the process of accessing that information to academic researchers should be shortened. And that is why we are proposing that research, because it is something that is beneficial in the end to public interest, should be included among the grounds that will amount or will lead to a public interest override. So So that if somebody applies for information and they can prove that it is for purposes of genuine research, then that information should be granted to him or her if the public interest in granting that information far outweighs the retention of that information. That is the argument. But if you look at the way FAIA and the bill works, if you look at Section 2, Subsection 4, the bill now makes the provision of this bill superior to FAIA. And it is saying that where there is a conflict between the bill and FAIA in areas of classified information, then the bill shall reign supreme. But it leaves it out in the area of protected information, that is the information that is not classified. And it is saying that in those instances where the information is not classified, a person can apply for access to that information either using this bill or FAIA. So in those respects, it's less open-ended. But where the information is classified, the bill is very clear that its provision shall reign supreme. And that is why we are saying that given this fact, the provisions of the bill should be made as open as possible and as quick as possible. Yes, I want to stop there. And
thank you very much. Thank you in relation to the Honourable MP Bloom's question about Samora Michelle and what happened to his flight, if I understood your question correctly, and whether that information should be released into the public domain as part of the automatic declassification of the protected area information. I think as a general rule, and this is what really guided our recommendation, as a general rule, we think it's critically important in order to put the past behind us and deal with the past once and for all, for what remains of apartheid's dirty secrets to come into the public domain, so that we can deal with them. They may be tricky to deal with, they may be potentially destabilizing, but it's going to be important for us as a country to close the chapter on that period in our history once and for all. And the only way to do that is to really understand the extent of the reach of the security apparatus of the state during that period. But as we said, if the committee feels that there are compelling grounds for information dating from the apartheid era not to be declassified automatically, then we think that it's prudent to insert a clause that requires that review of that particular information to be time bound. And depending on the genuine threat to national security that's posed by that particular information, then decisions about whether to classify, keep classified or declassified could be taken on a case by case basis. Now, I think in relation to the question once again about whether HISA is straying into areas that it shouldn't be straying into, sticking its nose into issues that it shouldn't be sticking its nose into, I suspect that we may have to agree to disagree on this particular issue. You know, the argument that we've made is that you know, research and teaching on the security cluster, we think, is of considerable public importance, not only for the citizenry as a whole to attempt to understand what's going on, but for the very people who work inside the security cluster. One of the points that was raised, you know, in preparation for the submission, when we were speaking to academics about, you know, how they found the research environment at the moment on the security cluster, was that it's extremely difficult to introduce into teaching information about recent problems that have emerged in the intelligence services, for instance. And so when one teaches intelligence failures, for example, one ends up having to revert to an international example like 9/11. Whereas the kind of lessons that can be drawn from more local and more recent examples, maybe the Sakimaki Zuma matter or the hoax emails matter, cannot really be drawn into teaching very easily, because many of the documents that relate to these particular instances are classified. And that impoverishes, I think, not only teaching for teaching and research for citizens generally who are engaged in academic work, but it impoverishes the understanding of the very members of the intelligence services who are undertaking postgraduate work and who are involved in learning environments around these particular issues. And this is why I made the point that a further consequence of that will probably be that academia becomes detached from the security cluster and cannot really speak to the practical problems that have arisen in such a way that those problems can be addressed in a learning environment and addressed in such a way that they can be prevented from happening again in future. I think Dr. Price has dealt with a specific example that I raised around the HIV prevalence in the military.
All right. No, thank you very much, Dr. Max, Dr. Jeffrey, Professor James, and Mr. Kett, for your presentation. I think it was quite enlightening, particularly with regard to the confusion that was created in terms of the role of the institutions of higher learning, the academia, research work, the position of the bill, and how it seeks to hamper academic work and development in the country. So I think you have assisted us a lot. You know, as we conclude, I just wanted to remind you that during the public hearings in provinces, in KwaZulu-Natal, in KwaMashu, not KwaMashu, which is something very interesting. I would love maybe the professors and so forth to interact with those universities there, because they had mobilized young and journalist students around the bill. But their understanding of the bill was only one thing, that they are at university in order to graduate, in order for them to be arrested and be sent to jail. That was as journalist students. Nothing else. And listening to your presentation, it is quite clear that you did apply your mind to the bill. And it is important that you share that experience, that attitude, and that approach also with other institutions, particularly professors, so that as they engage with their students and so forth, they shouldn't just channel them into one aspect, because you could see that these student journals, theirs was about the sentences that journalists were going to get if they happened to lay their hands on classified information, and that is all that they knew, nothing else. So thank you very much, and I hope that you'll assist them as well, and we'll make the point that they must get in contact with you so that you'll make them understand that these are the broader challenges that we are faced as the academia, more than just to look at the sentences that up-and-coming professionals who are going to emerge through institutions of higher learning are going to be challenged with. But thank you very much, honorable members. We are left with how many minutes? 20 minutes? Okay, fine. No, thank you very much for your patience and your assist. The meeting starts at 10.